Good afternoon, everyone. This little magic black box is supposed to be working. I guess it sounds like it. So that's good. Beautiful day. And here in the early part of winter, early January, that's absolutely wonderful. Even though we got about that much ice on our fountain today, last night. But Diane was all concerned about our little fruit trees and plants around the house, so you ought to see it now. It looks like some ghosts and goblins or something. Got white sheets over the top of a lot of the trees. But I hope it saves them. Anyhow, thank you, Paul, and enjoyed the message this morning already, or this afternoon. Thank you for that. A little bit of history in there, and we're going to have a little bit more history in mind, so that's kind of an interesting correlation. Very much different focus, though. The infamous attack and destruction of the World Trade Center Twin Towers took place nearly 12 years ago. Surprising how time goes by. Virtually everyone's familiar with that dramatic event, and it was, of course, motivated by Muslim men out of hate of America. We recognize that, and we recognize these kinds of things happen in the world and may happen more so. It shocked America. It caused a resurgence of church attendance. That was kind of the silver lining in a way to it. But at the time, the increased attendance was impressive, and yet it really didn't last very long. Is this working okay, Chris? It seems to be going up and down. Okay, I continue. It also sparked a wave of patriotic fervor where the whole country was calling for rebuilding of those towers that were destroyed. It caused the real intent to hunt down and do away with the main instigator of that, Osama bin Laden, and that has been done. And it seems we are all well on the way to completing the rebuilding program and gaining our sense of worth and national pride and confidence again. Well, wait a minute. Was a simple act of terrorism the cause, or does it go deeper than that? America, the United States of America, has been and still is the greatest and most powerful nation that's ever existed. Wouldn't God be somehow involved with what happened? Or is everything just a matter of time and chance and circumstance? Let's go to Daniel 2, because it's kind of the basis for things here. Daniel 2, and we'll read verse 20 to 22. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are His. And He changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with Him." He certainly did know what was happening here. He showed that power, that insight, that ability, even responsibility, if you will, with King Nebuchadnezzar in ancient Babylon. And I just wanted to make note of that at the start because it's an underpinning of the kind of material that I'm going to be covering today. So with that in mind, where does this very important event of 9/11 fit in? So I want to delve into some of the very interesting and even astonishing parallels with the ancient prophecies about Israel from over 2,500 years ago, which seem to have a direct application to our day, our history, and the massive event that occurred on 9/11. How can something that took place that long ago have anything to do with modern day, our time, 9/11 event? Well, in some ways, it has everything to do with it. And really, the current day economy, the housing debacle, the wars that have been going on in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the difficulties with Iran, the Wall Street crashes and the ups and downs and fluctuations, the credit world of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, all those kinds of issues, the financial cliff that we just think we did not fall over, but probably did. And, you know, we just read something about that massive bill that was passed for Sandy of $60 billion or something, it includes all kinds of pork. You know, you think if there's one time in life that politicians would want to do good for the country, it would be something like that. But they loaded up every state, every senator and congressman has got something he wants in his pocket. It's disgusting. And so this has something to do with all of that. I'll try to break the story down in little pieces. Number one, ancient Israel. We'll talk a little bit about ancient Israel. Let's read something about a passage in Isaiah. And I know Bill read something in Isaiah. I think there's one scripture actually we use the same one in, but we'll get to that. We often read of wars in one nation and all the military activities and events washing over the other nations, particularly in the Middle East. It's kind of confusing. Well, anyway, Assyria was the power of the day and was gobbling up lesser nations and coming against Israel. And the passage of interest is set in that time period of the fall of Israel in about the 8th century B.C. And Isaiah predicted in chapters 7 and 8, we're not going to read 7 and 8, but you are encouraged to do so, just get a better, fuller flavor of that. But anyway, the Galilee region was the first to fall to the Assyrians. And most of Israel fell in 734 B.C., but the Samarian area, and Samaria was the capital of Ephraim. We know Ephraim is one of the principal nations of the day, as we can best trace it, Ephraim and Manasseh, Britain and the United States. So, you know, it's all tying in here. Let's go here to Isaiah. I'm talking and not thinking of where I'm in the Bible. Isaiah chapter 7, first of all. In verse 4, it says, "Say to him, take heed, be quiet, do not fear, be faint-hearted, for those two stubs of smoking firebrands," in a way of characterizing a couple of the nations, "for the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria and the son of Remaliah." I only point that out to say that Rezin was the king. And so this talking about the riches and the spoil of Samaria will be taken away before the kings of Assyria. They're going to do them in. They're going to wipe out the country more or less. The interpreter's commentary states, "The moment of judgment is shown in relation to the confidence of those who regard their present setbacks as only temporary. What has fallen, they will rebuild again and better." Now turn over a page to Isaiah 9 and verse 10. "The bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with hewn stones. The sycamores are cut down, but we will replace them with cedars." What's it talking about? Hewn stone and sycamores. These are seemingly benign little comments that we just tend to read over these kind of things without much thought. We may be thinking something like, and I know I do this, that's kind of odd, but maybe I just don't know much about what's going on in that particular time period or era or peoples or nations. And well, the Bible often seems a little obscure anyway, and then go read right on. But hidden in here, I think, is something that's meaningful and ties in with our history. I want to try to explain that short passage and the attitude of Israel then. It's kind of a warning from God through the prophet Isaiah that something's wrong in their attitude and something's going to be done about it. Let's read verse 8. "The Lord sent a word," this is in Isaiah 9, verse 8, "The Lord sent a word against Jacob, and it has fallen on Israel. All the people will know, Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, who say in pride and arrogance of heart," and then goes ahead and says those words I read already in verse 10 about bricks falling and sycamores being cut down and rebuilding. In a way, that is a warning against virtually all of God's people, his favored nations that he's dealing with then and now. And what it's saying is that they were given in grave danger, or they were being in grave danger because of the pride and arrogance of their heart, the cause of them making these kinds of statements. And it's in verse 10, we see it kind of spelled out where the bricks have fallen, and it's referring to the breaching of the walls that is the protection of Israel in that time, and particularly Jerusalem, by the Assyrians. And it would be looked at as the beginning of the fall of the nation. And then we say, we will rebuild. In essence, they rely on self, not on God, for protection. And also it says, we will build with hewn stone. Well, what's the meaning of that? Well, this is signifying the rising of the level of the physical protection and strength to a point that the enemy won't be able to subdue them again. Bricks were mud and hay and that sort of thing, susceptible to weathering and also to an army coming against them, much easily broken through. But now, if it's built with hewn stone, maybe think like those big stones in the Temple Mount that we see in pictures and many of us have gone and seen. Huge, strong, much more so by comparison. So they're relying on their own strength and decisions rather than on God. And that's what he warns about. We can read the second part to be much the same. The sycamores are cut down, but we will replace those with cedars. The indication was that the Assyrian invasion was going to cut down all the sycamores in the whole territory, if you will, and shows a devastation of the land, which would certainly affect their coming back in any strength or whatever through agriculture or anything else in their area or building. Well, that was to foreshadow the nation's collapse and a sign of the uprooting of the kingdom. A sign from God that these things were going to come about. In ignoring the warning, it's as if it's a prophetic judgment on Israel. I think it really is when you consider the things that we've come to understand in Church of God in recent decades. Well, we're going to return to that in a little bit, but now I'm going to jump to something else. Historic. America and its beginnings. I'm going to make note of a few interesting points, and ultimately it'll tie in. You may not see that in it immediately, but we'll get there. We know of a few of the early events of our independence in the 1770s. Britain had imposed a tax on tea, and the colonists were protesting that because they had no voice in the court of the king in England. And lots of events followed on from that, and skirmishes and writing of the Declaration of Independence. Actually, there were two written. Establishing a Continental Congress, a war, George Washington as general, and then the signing of the Treaty of Independence in Paris in 1783. Considering these events, where did the U.S. really begin? 4,000 years ago with Abram. Really? Let's go to Genesis chapter 12. Okay, Genesis 12 and verse 1 through 3. Now the Lord had said to Abram, "Get out of your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." It's a promise to Abram to make of him, from him, a great nation, and bless them, all of his family. And I think we've been through that within church studies and articles and so forth a great deal over the past. The church in the sequence that has thoroughly outlined the things that occurred from Abram, Isaac, Jacob, renamed Israel, of course, his sons to Joseph, and Joseph then to Ephraim and Manasseh as the more prominent ones, even then. But this goes back a long way. I'm not going to rehearse all that history, but we see that coming forward to become ultimately the United States. In Genesis 49, let's turn there a moment. 49 and verse 1 and 2. And Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father." And then it goes through the blessings of the various sons. And I wanted to get down to verse 22. Joseph is a fruitful bough. A fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. Verse 24, but his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong, and the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. For there is the shepherd of the stone of Israel, by the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, and blessings of the deep that lies beneath, and so forth it goes. Blessings, blessings, blessings that God bestowed on Ephraim and Manasseh as part of Israel, the greater Israel. And we've traced that out, and we see that the nation of the United States has really been the recipient of those blessings, those massive blessings that he was giving to Ephraim and Manasseh in particular. Now I want to go to Deuteronomy chapter 28. Now, if this seems complicated, it's only because it is. But I think entwined in here are some interesting things when we get there. Deuteronomy 28, and verse 1 and 2. Now, it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all of his commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations on earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. Very important. Kind of wrap up of that. You're going to be recipients of fabulous blessings if you obey the words of our Father. And they're certainly all about Israel, but really most more applicable to the United States in the ultimate fulfillment. There's lots of blessings to talk about. I'm going to skip over what I had in my notes about them. But you ought to take a look at some of these. Verse 5 and 7 and 8 and 12 and 13 and 15 and so forth. Let's see, one I wanted to especially make sure to read is 14. Deuteronomy 28, verse 14. So you shall not turn aside from any of the words which I command you this day, to the right hand or to the left, to go after other gods, to serve them. So it's a warning, another warning. God's always giving warnings to his people. And sometimes we see a minor fulfillment, other times a bit more, sometimes a massive fulfillment. And looking on further in time, we probably expect the more massive fulfillments to come. Let's go to Leviticus to go along with this area. You know, Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, the blessings and cursings chapter. We'll go to Leviticus 26 and verse 6. I will give you peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. That's a good blessing. We've experienced that. We've lived that in the United States as a fulfillment and truth in that. It's a very especially important blessing from God. I will give peace, and no sword will go through your land. Now, we read so much in all the events in the Bible about nation against nation and the armies overcoming or, you know, overflowing and wiping out nations, whole nations. But think, the United States has never had a foreign nation overrun our land. Closest thing to it, I suppose, was an attack on Pearl Harbor, and we really didn't have an invasion. It was an outside attack and withdrawn. So this came true. In verse 14, if you do not obey me and do not observe all these commandments, and if you despise my statutes, or if your soul abhors my judgments so that you do not perform all of my commandments but break my covenant, I also will do this to you. I'll even appoint terror over you wasting disease and fever, which shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart, and you shall sow your seed in vain, and your enemies shall eat it, and so forth. So another, you know, massive prophetic warning, if you will, that we as a people should not despise our God, not reject Him, not fire Him, not put Him out of our life. And so here's the result. It seems in 9/11 we have had a steady decline in our hedge of protection from God. Now, we haven't been invaded. We don't have armies overrunning us and so forth. But I think it's interesting. He says, I'll appoint terror over you. Well, what was 9/11 considered? A terrorist attack. What have we had since then? We chase an enemy we can't identify and can't see. Oh, sure, we've had a lot of things that are done and a lot of people captured or killed or what have you, but the majority of those people still have a hatred for America and they're still out there somewhere and we don't know exactly who or where. So I think to an extent the protection that God had promised us if we stayed faithful to Him is diminished, if not withdrawn. Some other interesting details, I think, about the formation of our country, and they do pertain to this. I'm getting off of this particular tack a little bit. Today, our capital is Washington, D.C. That's the third location, third formal location. And prior to that, it was Philadelphia, and in first, for 2 years, it was New York City. There are some that say, well, the Congress met here, there, and another place, so you could say that was a location for the government. Nine altogether, I think it was. Three formal and six others. But anyway, New York City was for 2 years the capital, formally. George Washington gave his first inaugural address, and that was given in Federal Hall, which was on, where of all places, Wall Street. And what were one of the promises that God gave us? You know, some financial growth and hugely recognized around the world as a center of wealth, power. Well, and it centers on Wall Street. Well, that's where George Washington gave his first address. That's the focal point on formation and ultimate financial capital of the world. He made a lot of comments in his address showing his belief and reliance on God. And I did print his inaugural address, and I wanted to read a couple of the items that he said that demonstrate his reliance on God. Kind of a fulfillment of what God was saying there to Abraham, and every descendant down the line should not depart from God. George Washington didn't. He stood strong in his belief in God. And he says in part, it would be peculiarly improper to omit this first official act of my fervent supplication to that almighty being who rules over the universe, who presides in the councils of nations, and whose providential aids can supply every human defect, and that his benediction may consecrate to the liberties and happiness of the people of the United States a government instituted by themselves for these essential purposes and may enable every instrument employed in its administration to execute success the functions allotted to his charge. Kind of old, Englishy, complicated statement, but it's clear George Washington placed the importance of how the United States was formed because of God. Goes on, no people can be bound to acknowledge and adore the invisible hand which conducts the affairs of men more than those of the United States. Every step by which they have advanced to the character of an independent nation seems to have been distinguished by some token of providential agency. Shows he absolutely knew the United States with all the complications, with all these things that happened leading up to the formation of the nation were dependent on God. It couldn't have happened without God bringing those things to pass. He also gave a warning in the address. And I kind of look at this because it's a correlation with how God treated ancient Israel, and I think his meaning is for us today. We ought to be no less persuaded that propitious smiles of heaven can never be expected on a nation that disregards the eternal rules of order and right which heaven itself has ordained. Now, it's a little complicated way also of saying we better not forget God. We better not deviate from his ways, or we'll have a little bit of trouble down the road. So it's quite clear that this nation was founded by moral Christian leaders who openly and publicly and gratefully relied on God for its beginning, for its establishment, and for guidance along the way in all of its affairs. And it's also apparent that they recognized that if we forgot those origins, we forgot God and disregarded that, that these magnificent blessings would be lost eventually. And sadly, I think our nation does not have that view anymore. We've become very secular. We rely on our own resources, our own power, rather than the providence or blessings and protection of God. As a nation, we've just forgotten it. We think we're independent. We can do our own thing. Get out of my face with anything to do with religion. We see it over and over in the public arena. Now, right after his swearing in and that inaugural address, Washington led the members of Congress to St. Paul's Cathedral. Probably many of you have seen that right downtown in Manhattan. So that was his first act, lead them in prayer in that location. It's been a historic landmark since 1960, but this is considered his first act as president, right after the inauguration itself. And he led the nation in prayer, dedicated to God, and asked God's blessing for the Union, for the nation. Now, St. Paul's is located right at Ground Zero. The rear faces Church Street, right across from the Trade Center. When the towers fell, St. Paul's was survived intact without so much as a window broken, right across the street. It was the only building close by that survived. Interestingly, between the towers of St. Paul's was a large sycamore tree. Think back about Isaiah, the prophecy about sycamores being cut down. Well, the sycamore was uprooted and had absorbed much of the force of the impact of the falling debris that saved St. Paul's. And now there's a great big bronze sculpture. It's a whole root structure of that kind of a tree. It's got all kinds of, you know, root branches off of it, and it's there as a perpetual memorial for what had occurred. In 2003, November, an evergreen tree was planted right where that sycamore tree had stood. On July 4, 2004, a 20-ton stone of native New York Adirondack granite was laid as a symbolic connection to where the new tower was going to be built and to honor those who died. The new tower became a symbol of American strength and confidence in itself. It's a commitment and statement of becoming better, stronger than ever by ourselves. Now, that may be a great patriotic thing to do, but as we, Bible students, as God's church, God's children, we should rely on God, not on the greater strength of a cedar tree. Evergreen is, in this case, a species of the cedar tree mentioned back in Isaiah. And we should not think the greater strength of a granite stone is the important thing, but the important thing is God and our reliance on him. And our early fathers saw that in what I've shown you about what George Washington had made comments about here. We should humbly turn back to God rather than thinking ourselves able to do the impossible. Today, America as a people, as a nation, has forgotten God. Now, maybe worse than that, as a nation, we have rejected God, dissed God, declared independence from God, and come to rely on our own strength. Now, you know, you see so many things on television that keep God out of the picture. Try to keep God out of the schools, God out of any public gathering, God out of even the halls of our legislatures, at least in the states. So ancient Israel had made that same mistake, and we read in Isaiah 9 and 8 that the Lord sent a word, a message, a warning against Jacob that fell on Israel and the United States and Britain due to the arrogance of heart that begat these kinds of modern-day things that we see. So I ask, isn't America essentially saying the same thing that the ancient Israelites said in their attitude? Okay, got to move along. Today's America a little bit. I want to go back to some of the words of Isaiah we touched on earlier because some of those details then apply now. In the wake of the calamity, the nation's responds without repentance, without humility or reflection of where we are, where we came from, where we're going. And instead of that kind of response, it's with pride and arrogance. A lot of times, the public statements that are made after that event are, we will rebuild. Again, sounds nice and patriotic and determined on the surface. But it's kind of a first sign of defiance. They pledge to make it bigger, better, stronger, taller, however you can phrase it. I'm just going to mention a few of those. The Senate Majority Leader, the day after that, spoke that we would rebuild and quoted Isaiah 9, verse 10 that we read. 3 years later, John Edwards, I mean, he's been disgraced since, but at the time he was a vice presidential running mate of John Kerry, and so he had a lot of listeners and some influence. He also quoted Isaiah 9:10. Obama, several months ago, speaking from the site, said America would rebuild and be stronger. New York City Mayor said, we will rebuild. New York Governor said, we will rebuild. The state's senior senator said, we will rebuild. The state's junior senator said, we will rebuild. So, you know, you can't get away from the fact that that was our determination. The leaders of our country, the prominent tribe of modern day of Israel, the one who's effectively in the leadership role, as of now, I think, God isn't in the picture at all. They were all in agreement. We will rebuild. We emphasized. God's not in the picture. And so we see these things here, that these leaders tied the statements made in Isaiah, I've lost Isaiah, here he is, had made all that long time ago. Tied that specific scripture to speeches being made modern times about we're going to rely on ourselves and we're going to rebuild and be bigger, better, and stronger. I'll go back to Isaiah 9. The Lord sent a word against Jacob, and it has fallen on Israel, and the people will know Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, who say in pride and in arrogance of heart, the bricks have fallen. We're going to build it better. The sycamores have been cut down. We're going to build it better. And so forth. I didn't want to make mention that, you know, it says here that the sycamores are going to be replaced with cedars, and I think I briefly touched on, but the fact that there is an evergreen tree that was presented as a gift and planted there is an evergreen tree. It doesn't sound the same as what it does in Isaiah, but people have traced it out and found that that same species is of cedar. Whatever the evergreen tree type was called a conifer tree, but I think that's a very broad naming of it. Anyway, it's a variety of cedar. So the statements made in ancient Israel and the statements made and the actual acts performed that fulfill those particular statements for modern-day Israel are, in fact, directly correlated and exactly the same. Now, what's this all lead to? we see that there was a warning to Israel, and in effect, through these events, a warning to America that there's problems out there. We're not going to really be able to solve them all. We're going to have to face up to the fact that as a nation, we've left God, and if we're on our own defending against those kinds of things in the world, we're not going to destroy it. We're not going to survive it even. We've seen the destruction of ancient Israel and the destruction of a major symbol of America. It's like this is a crack in the wall. It puts it in the Bible as a gap in the protective wall. And it's just the beginning. It's the start of a stronger invasion. We've seen arrogant and defiant statements about rebuilding bigger, better, stronger, both then and now. We've seen this terminology of the bricks have fallen, and you correlate that with the structure and some bricks of the Trade Center, just as that prophecy foretold. We've seen the comments about rebuilding with hewn stone in ancient Israel and the same kind of thing, hewn Adirondack granite as a cornerstone, a very solid base to begin with for the Freedom Tower. We've seen this replanting a cedar tree in place of the destroyed sycamores. And all of this correlates with the warnings given to Israel and given to us. Isaiah 9 and verse 12 for a moment. The Syrians before and the Philistines behind, and they shall devour Israel with an open mouth. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. We see all sorts of adversaries that kind of correlate with this statement here of they shall devour Israel with an open mouth. There are people all around the world that hate America. There are people who speak out of what they think is correct and true, and they don't like us. And particularly so, it seems, in the Middle East. So this vocalization is like the Israel being devoured with an open mouth, as it's phrased in Isaiah. Verse 13, for the people do not turn to him who strikes them, nor do they seek the Lord of hosts. So we see a continuation of that. We're not, as a nation, seeking God. We're not recognizing we're in any kind of trouble, other than what the politicians say, we're going to fall off the cliff tomorrow unless we vote and on money and save us, save ourselves. And even that's corroded and corrupted. But it's certainly not saying, God, we've done a lot of wrong things and we need your help to get us out of this. That's what we should be doing as a nation. So that seems to fit our nation now as morality of our country slides downhill rather quickly. And our populace more and more are rejecting God and their thinking and their commitments. Well, George Washington depended on God to lead the country with great results. And he warned that if it ever came to the point that we did not rely on God, we're going to fail. And early on, that great story prevailed. The United States became the greatest nation the world has ever seen, the most powerful, the most economically stable. We had to have a standard of living still. It's far better than anyone else. And yet all these things are ultimately going to be lost. I wanted to go to Daniel 4. Daniel 4, and Nebuchadnezzar was the ruler of the most powerful nation of history at that time, but he was lifted up with pride also. And I wanted to get down here to verse 37, and it says, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth, and his ways, justice, and those who walk in pride, he is able to abase. So it shows, once again, God's in charge. Even Nebuchadnezzar finally was brought to understand that and tell that publicly, admit that publicly for his kingdom and his rule of it. We could learn that lesson. We don't have a king, but close to it, it seems. And if he would just turn, as Nebuchadnezzar was forced to do, and do what God said in all these passages, turn to God, admit what we've done and where we are and the help we need, then we'd have a different outcome. God didn't cause 9/11, but it seems he certainly did remove his wall of protection about the nation and allowed this warning message to speak loudly to the country, if we would hear it. The lesson of the attack, the destruction, and the impending slide downwards that's resulted from it. God's in charge, no question. And we should recognize that and acknowledge that, as King Nebuchadnezzar did. So I think that is something, these lessons are something that the nation in particular, the Church of God, sure, we more, of course, rely on God than any other organization, but we can continue to keep that foremost in our mind, and certainly as individuals we need to keep that in mind. We need to watch world affairs, note what's shaping up, the events of prophecy and how they're being fulfilled. And individually, of course, we need to recognize and admit to and follow the attitudes that the Bible tells us we should have. One other scripture I wanted to turn to is in Luke 21. You may recognize the number. Luke 21, and this verse 36 tells us, "Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man." Very important to us, isn't it? Well, while the correlations between Israel and the United States are intriguing, these little things about the stone then and the stone now, the sycamores then and the cedar now, I think those are fascinating to see over all these centuries, not centuries, millennium. God has said, this is what's going to happen, and here today we see an exact fulfillment of some of those items. Very detailed, really obscure until you happen to turn a spotlight on them and come to see that God is in charge. He can bring all these things exactly together the way he planned to and prophesied to. And so I think it's important that we understand these things from time to time and to see God's hand in all the events that are leading up to the return of Jesus Christ.